Welcome back to New Books in Military History. This is your host, Bob Winterman. Today our guest is Kelly Denton Borhaug, Associate Professor in Religion at Moravian College in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, and the author of U.S. War Culture, Sacrifice and Salvation. Now, I was drawn to this book after reading several excerpts from it on the Library of Social Sciences weblog. And at that time, Professor Denton Borhaug's work stood out because of the hard questions it posed with regard to the state of our collective social discourse on war, and how we've entered a point where we frequently interchange contextual rhetoric on war with that of sacrifice, without really considering the historical and philosophical antecedents for such a mix of linguistic tropes. Now, it's rooted as much in philosophical and psychological heuristics as larger considerations about the relationship between military institutions and popular military culture within a representative democracy. U.S. war culture, sacrifice, and salvation also compels the reader to confront his or her own belief system as it relates to national identity and the extent to which sacrificial rhetoric should be permitted to suffuse our most essential concepts of defense policy in place of war in our society. Now, certainly a challenging book. I can also say without question, it's one of the more important books that I've read this year. So with that said, Kelly, welcome to New Books in Military History.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here.
Great. I have to start with the obvious lead-in. You know, what exactly prompted you to pursue this project?
Yeah, that's a great question. And to answer it, I really have to go back to the experiences of 9/11. In the years just prior to that really momentous watershed moment in American experience and history, I was finishing my PhD. My background is in theological ethics. And I was working on mapping and analyzing the criticisms raised by a whole collection of women writers of theological ethics and Christianity from about the 1970s through the 1990s. And they were raising specific criticisms about understandings that are predominant in related to Christian understandings of salvation. And in particular, many of these writers talked a lot about sacrifice. And I had been studying sacrifice and reading many highly critical theological analyses of sacrifice in this body of literature. I assumed upon entering the academy and beginning my teaching career and research career that I would continue in that same vein. But then 9/11 happened. And I think because of my training and my educational and research experiences, what happened in our culture struck me in a way that perhaps it didn't many other people. I felt as if I had been really directly assaulted by what I saw as the surging of sacrificial rhetoric in popular culture, in political culture, in military culture. I was really struck by the way in which this rhetoric was being used, as I saw it, to simultaneously promote war and at the same time discourage citizens from thinking too deeply about what we were doing. And I also wondered very much about the connections between this surging of sacrificial rhetoric all over the culture and its connections to Christian religion. So this represented a whole array of knots that I began to unravel. And at first I really didn't realize that I was writing a book. I was writing a series of articles trying to look at this from a number of diverse theoretical perspectives. And eventually I realized that this really was a book that I was writing, and that eventually became U.S. War Culture, Sacrifice, and Salvation.
Okay. Well, I'm going to ask you if you can define war culture, and you know, comment perhaps on how exactly you feel it runs contrary to American moral and civic culture.
Right. So I have defined war culture as the normalized interpenetration, and that word is really important, interpenetration, of the ethos, institutions, and practices of war with ever-increasing facets of daily human life in the United States. And I explore a number of facets. It's certainly not an exhaustive list. But I explore the economy, education, religion, entertainment, many other diverse cultural sites, including patterns of labor and consumption, and perhaps most important, even our capacity for imagination, the interpenetration between the specific ethos and institutions and practices of war with all of these different sites of culture. What's significant about this, and what I drew especially from Catherine Lutz's study on militarization, was the way in which this interpenetration leads towards the shaping of an entire culture such that the goals of all sorts of institutions more and more become synchronous with those of military institutions. And that was what I was really interested to try to understand. At the same time, as this interpenetration takes place and war culture becomes simultaneously normalized and legitimated, it also tends to become less visible to us as citizens. Mm-hmm. So it sort of descends to a more subconscious level. And that means that we tend less to question it or really even see it. And this became very obvious to me as I was working. In fact, as I began speaking about the relationship between sacrifice and war culture, I encountered from my audiences a lot of pushback.
Sure.
What do you mean?
Imagine. Yeah.
What do you mean we live in a war culture? I don't believe that. This is not a war culture. And I realized that I had to go back and actually make the case for why many scholars do understand the United States as now really expressing this reality. And so that was why I wrote chapter one, which sort of lays out the case for war culture. That was not the first chapter that I wrote. I wrote that relatively late in the game. But I realized that in order for people to understand why this analysis of sacrifice and war culture was important, first, I had to make that case and make it convincingly.
Okay. Well, you know, I think, you know, your definition of war culture isn't exactly new. I mean, as a military mm-hmm. historian, I can look back at other critics and historians who have in the past described the cultural fixation of martial virtues in the United States, going back at least to Walter Millis's book, The Martial Spirit, describing America on the eve and after the Spanish-American War. What I think is interesting, though, is that you present contemporary war culture as being intertwined with a particularly strong form of religiosity and militarism. Mm-hmm. Can you expand upon that?
Let me say just a little bit about how I understand the distinctiveness of war culture in the contemporary United States. And one way to do that actually might be to share an example of the way that interpenetration works. And the way that it works in ways that tend to be below the conscious awareness of many or most American citizens. Mm-hmm. One example that I talk about in my book is the Army Experience Center that was in Philadelphia in the years, I think, about 2007 to maybe 2010 or so. Mm-hmm. This was a... it was called an attraction center by the Army. It was funded by tax dollars. Scholars who look at this really identify it as a site for military brand enhancement and recruitment. And huge amounts of money were poured into centers such as this to develop and portray and communicate a particular image of the Army and enforce it. So, in this case, tax dollars worked together to support the initiative of the Army with the help of a huge marketing company called Ignited Corporation and the makers of the video game Halo to develop this center with military simulators such as Humvees and other simulator sites that would be attractive, especially to teenage boys. And this center was located in a suburban mall right next to a skate park that was a huge site for teenagers looking for something exciting to do. And trained recruiters operated this site, and it was declared by none other than the U.S. Army to have really raised recruitment numbers during some of the years of the Iraq War when recruitment numbers were really falling in other parts of the country. So why does this represent interpenetration? Here we see these huge systems coming together. The systems that represent the U.S. Army, marketing corporations, video gaming corporations, all coming together to work together to form this sort of seamless experience. And then, you know, young, mostly male teenagers being attracted to it and being presented with a very sophisticated portrayal of what it will be like to join the military. That's interpenetration. And I think that that is different from the way that militarization has operated at other points along the way of American history. It's now highly sophisticated. It involves vast corporate and systemic entities. And that makes it simultaneously below the surface of conscious awareness for many, many people, but also extremely effective in terms of shaping images, entering people's imagination, and affecting the way that they think, see, and value.
I see. Well, again, though, turning back to the question I raised about Millis and the martial spirit, and the idea of the differences between what has formerly, I guess, been a largely secular sense of war culture in our past, what you're describing as one being intertwined within religiosity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, can you comment on how that is different?
Right, sure. I guess the place to start is to say that in my research, I discovered that this connection between sacrifice and war culture is anything but new.
Right.
In fact, it's very ancient. And it is fairly widely recognized, although I would say it's only really beginning to be analyzed by researchers of many different disciplines. I remember first coming across sociologist Catherine Albanese's description of the way that she saw sacrificial rhetoric surging at times of potential or actual war throughout American history. And since this was something that I observed so distinctly from a firsthand perspective following 9/11, I was so struck by that.
Right.
I wanted to try to understand when this connection began and how it began. And I think I might say two things along those lines. First of all, I've learned that there is a huge debate among scholars regarding how to understand war with relationship to human nature.
Oh, yeah.
There's certainly the Hobbesian view, right, that the two are very closely intertwined. But there is a whole body of scholarship that raises questions about that assumption.
Well, that's the core of the entire war and society movement, I think, in the historian's field, where we try to understand the place of war as a social exercise and how it shapes the society, so both wage it, but also, you know, tangentially affected by it, you know, even amongst neutral powers, perhaps.
Right, right. And what I've learned is that sacrifice and war seem to be very closely intertwined. And sacrifice is a dynamic that operates in all kinds of different human spheres. It flips between different spheres of human understanding and practice and activity. It is deeply religious, but it is not always simply religious. And as I've come to analyze and understand it, what I've seen happen over and over again is the way in which religious, specifically religious understandings of sacrifice slip into other cultural areas. So that, I mean, this is why I describe this as a civil religious understanding or a civil religious practice. It slips back and forth between specifically religious sites and those which are much more kind of politically or, let's say, civilly oriented. What I found interesting and what I set about to do in my book was to think about the kinds of criticisms that women writers had been levying over against sacrifice in Christianity, and to think about whether those same criticisms might make sense with respect to the way that I saw sacrifice operating in U.S. war culture. So that's really what I set about to do in this book. And I can summarize, if you'd like, what that critique of sacrifice over against Christianity is from the perspective of many of these women writers. Would that be helpful?
Yeah, sure, sure.
So I think I can, although this is, the literature about this is really quite vast and the criticisms are many and diverse, I think I can summarize them somewhat under three different headings.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, these writers charge that sacrifice creates a kind of electricity to the practices of violence. Now, this made more sense to me when I came across the work of George Lakoff and his work on cognitive metaphors.
Mm-hmm.
He talks about sacrifice as a cognitive metaphor across many human cultures and one that is certainly extremely dominant in contemporary American culture. A cognitive metaphor is a metaphor that tends to be expressed in our language, and it's a kind of logic that we use without even really thinking about that logic.
Right.
So whenever we use language like is it really worth it, or we have to pay the price, or whenever we engage in a kind of thinking that equates moral credit with having to suffer something to earn moral credit,
right,
we are in a kind of sacrificial discursive realm. We're in the realm of this sacrificial cognitive metaphor. That creates a kind of electricity. It's familiar to us, and we resonate with it. This is one of the criticisms, then, that these writers from this body of women's literature have levied over against this. This tends to electrify and ease our way into all kinds of practices of violence.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the first charge. The second charge has to do with the way that sacrificial labels and practices simultaneously conceal the mechanisms of violence and its destruction. So when we look at what actually happens in sacrificial systems, we see that frequently, all too frequently, it's people who are on the periphery of social influence and privilege who are ground up and destroyed in sacrificial exchange. And that's where the feminist criticism and also criticisms from a liberation theology weigh in.
Right.
So that's a second criticism that is levied over against sacrificial thinking and practice. And then a third criticism has to do with the way in which sacrificial cognitive metaphors sacralize or sacramentalize violence. And the best way I know of to get at this is really very simple. We use precisely the same language in our culture to talk about the death of soldiers and the death of Jesus Christ on the cross. Mm-hmm. Do you know what it is that we say, which is absolutely identical about these deaths, how we describe them? We call them the ultimate sacrifice. One finds this is the descriptor that is replete throughout theological literature regarding the sacrifice of Jesus. It is also the most common descriptor that we find with regard to the way we struggle with and try to come to terms with the reality of the death of military service members. And so what happens then within this is that the terror, the destructiveness, and the question about whether conflict might be addressed through some other mechanism, all of this tends to be sublimated by way of this divinization. So these were the criticisms of sacrifice from this body of literature that I had been studying that I really tried to address with respect to better understanding the way that sacrifice works in contemporary U.S. war culture.
Okay. Well, I have to say, you know, first, some of these critiques that you're describing, they're not just unique, I think, to religious scholars or to feminist scholars. I mean, I could think of many people working in the war and society field, for example, who also raise similar concerns about the appeal of the sacrificial metaphor and its overuse, or the idea about how the repeated use of violent metaphor or victimization metaphor, and I want to talk about victimization metaphor with you shortly, kind of charges the society and elevates the tone and context of war violence, both real and imagined, you know, real on the battlefield, but imagined on the home front. I find it's interesting that you're appropriating it or addressing this from that strictly feminist perspective, but I think it's fair to say also that this is a similar critique across the humanities, I think, towards war culture, as you described it, war language. I do want to turn back to the religiosity aspect again, perhaps get even more literal or more contemporary. You know, I have to ask, is there a sectarian quality to this war cultural trope? I mean, that is to say, is it uniform across American Christian denominations, or is it specific to Catholicism or Protestantism, or even stepping outside of Christianity, Judaism, as expressed in the United States?
Well, I've discovered that it is, first of all, it's an extremely common ingredient in American culture.
Yeah,
generally
very much so.
So I think that's the first thing that has to be said before we start to think about its presence in specific religious communities.
Right.
It is common to American culture, and I have traced this back to the beginnings of what we think of as American history, pre-Revolutionary War.
John Winthrop, perhaps,
I'm not recalling the name of this scholar now, but a scholar who traced some of the early battles of the Revolutionary War and identifying preachers who interpreted the violence as being divinely inspired.
I think it's Charles
and
Royster.
Approved.
I think you may be referencing Charles Royster, but I digress.
So, you know, this has been with us. And I'm asked about the way in which this predates the American experience as well as finds expression in other cultures in contemporary times. I know that it absolutely does predate American experience and that there are many expressions of this around the world. But my purpose, and really my purpose still is, especially to try to understand how this works in our own setting in the United States.
Right.
And I really felt that as sort of a keen responsibility, given A, the size of our war culture, and B, the impact of our war culture, not only on this nation, but around the world. So it seemed to me that it was really, and also, especially in the years, in the first decade, I would say, post 9/11, and I write about this a little bit in my book, that as scholars began to think and write more about violence, it seemed to me that so much of that focus was on the violence outside of our culture.
Yeah.
We wanted to know why suicide bombers behave as they do, what motivates them. We wanted to understand religious extremism outside of the United States and its connection to violence. But it seemed to me that we were really too little focused on understanding ourselves. Mm-hmm. And that there was not enough emphasis or analysis on the exponential increase of our own violence in those same years. And so I really set about to do that. So that's the first thing to be said, then, that this trope is dominant from the pre-beginnings of American history and experience and culture. But then to address your question about the specifically religious content of it, this is a really interesting question, and to answer it, what I have to do, or what I really began to do in my research, is to try to make some distinctions between popular religious culture as opposed to various forms of ecclesial religious culture.
Right.
Because there are differences. In popular religious culture, and the dominance of sacrificial cognitive metaphors and images in American culture, generally speaking, I think are really pretty similar, and they impact one another. And in popular culture, popular American religious culture, the sacrificial metaphor that most predominates is one that is related to a theological metaphor called penal substitution. I don't know if you will ever have heard of this term before.
I think that's fair to say, yes.
That metaphor understands the sacrificial work of Jesus in this way. Jesus dies on the cross and suffers as a kind of substitution for the suffering that God righteously demands of all human beings as a payment for sin. So Jesus is a substitute or a surrogate and suffers on behalf of human sinfulness. And his suffering pays the price. It removes the stain of human suffering. It reconciles human beings with God. This is the image of penal substitution that is predominant in popular American Christianity. I want to say that also is the dominant religious metaphor, especially in evangelical Protestantism, and one finds it throughout other denominations, if less centrally. But I have been struck at the way in which this understanding, I'll put it this way, it bleeds into all kinds of other ways that we talk about sacrifice in terms of war.
Mm-hmm.
So how often in trying to come to terms with the death of soldiers do we talk about them dying as a kind of exchange for something else? It might be an exchange for freedom or an exchange for democracy or exchange for the evil that is represented by some other group.
Right?
So there's definitely a kind of mixing and interchange that happens in terms of these patterns of thinking. So I think that way of thinking is more dominant, and it has been identified by scholars as being more dominant, certainly in popular religious thinking and evangelical Protestantism. However, I find it throughout Christian denominations. And that probably has to do with the fact that it is the popular religious imagination in the United States.
Right. Well, you know, it's like, as I listen to your comments, you know, it brings me back to what I was thinking when I was reading through the book, the first chapters of the book. And I kept running back to think about someone who I read as a graduate student. It was Paul Boyer. His work, seminal works on religiosity in American culture. For my listeners, that would be 1985's By the Bomb's Early Light, American Thought and Culture at the Dawn of the Atomic Age. And his 1994 book, When Time Shall Be No More, Prophecy, Belief in Modern American Culture. You know, both these works, Boyer notes how evangelical Pentecostalism was really adept at incorporating nuclear power into its own eschatology-based view of Christianity. I want to ask, how does that relate to the themes of sacrifice and militarism that you're addressing?
I was really fascinated by Boyer's analysis of what happened in post-Hiroshima America in the late 1940s and 1950s. And what fascinated me about his analysis was that he showed that many more people were really uncomfortable with what happened than I think we often tend to assume in the United States. And many church people across diverse denominations were extremely uncomfortable. And that there was really the beginnings of a kind of collective protest and resistance to what had taken place.
Within the mainstream denominations.
Yes. But you're right in noting the way, not only that, as I understand his analysis, not only that Protestant evangelicalism had played an important role, but once again, we see interpenetration taking place here in concert with other huge systems from the military and from the government, I would say. So what he describes is the way that evangelical Protestantism channeled all of this into a much more individualistic apocalyptic interpretation. So as opposed to a collective protest, a collective ethical response, this kind of genocidal destruction is not something that we should do, right?
Right.
The way that it came to be expressed in evangelical Protestant terms was that the ultimacy of the bomb meant that you should make sure you're saved. You should make sure that you as an individual are right with God.
Right.
This was what the ultimacy of the bomb really demanded. And he identifies Billy Graham, especially, as being just an excellent proponent of this way of thinking. But that interpenetrated with these other systemic forces that were simultaneously working to pacify, to legitimize, and normalize atomic weapons. At one point in his book, he has a series of illustrations that show cartoons and magazine advertisements and instructions from government associations about how to protect yourself in case of an atomic bomb attack. So all of these things really worked together, as I understand his analysis. Yes, Protestant apocalyptic understanding played a, and not only that, but the whole strain of individualism that is so dominant in American culture, right? All of these things came together and developed into a particular way that Americans came to accept the presence of the bomb. And his conclusion to me that ultimately Americans found facing the reality of the destructiveness of this weaponry too painful and too frightening to fully face.
Right.
It's a very powerful conclusion.
Yeah. Well, I have to wonder, too. I mean, I get the sense, again, to read your book and think about the Boyer. Of course, so he talks about how American Protestantism, I'm singling that out, not Boyer, adopts the bomb into its eschatology and accepts it, comes to accept it that way. Well, then around 1991, that paramount fear that had been prophesied for 20, 30 years disappears. Does Then, picking up with your book, I mean, is it safe to say that perhaps 2001 provides that new bridge or that new vehicle for eschatology-based Christians, you know, who were looking at the bomb as a realization of God's design? Perhaps now 2001 is a vehicle for them to again return to social or cultural prominence, or, you know, I'm trying to identify a link between atomic culture and the culture of war sacrifice that you're describing.
Mm-hmm. One way that I might respond to it would be to just share a kind of a continuing question that I have.
Uh-huh.
It's become clear to me over the years of my research and thinking about all of this that the existence of sacrificial war culture, well, let me put it this way. Sacrifice in war culture has been fairly adroitly manipulated.
Yes.
Intentionally. By at various places and by various individuals, right? But I don't think it can be fully explained in that way. There is something much deeper to this. It also is simply a part of the cultural sediment. It's in other words, thinking, and I'm beginning to explore this much more in current research that I'm doing. I'm returning to Johann Galtung's understanding of cultural and structural and then direct forms of violence.
Right.
And the interrelationships between those three different types of violence. And sacrificial warring violence really has roots that are at that deepest level in culture. So in bedrock notions of and practices of identity and logic and ways of seeing the world.
Right.
And so it has been intentionally used as a manipulative force, but it isn't only that. I've addressed it specifically in the post 9/11 period.
Right.
But it would be very interesting, and in fact, others have done this. Richard Koenigsberg of the Library of Social Science website,
mm-hmm.
his analysis has been to try to understand how this worked in National Socialism in Germany in the 1930s and 40s.
I recall reading that, yes.
Mm-hmm. And I think he has really very persuasively demonstrated how, I don't want to say that it's exactly the same as what's going on in the United States, but how that particular expression
right.
of sacrificial war culture really played a very key role in the Holocaust.
Right. Well, I mean, I can also think, too, in terms of, as speaking as an American story,
mm-hmm.
as an Americanist, if we accept the premise that what becomes the United States is rooted from its very beginnings in a sense of religious exceptionalism or of a special relationship with
yes. the
government, then it stands to reason that that would remain an undercurrent that would be informed perhaps by war culture.
Mm-hmm.
But could also stand alone from the 17th century through to the 21st century, in the American experience.
Yeah, that's and I'm really glad that you identified that theme of American exceptionalism and the way in which this is informed by religious notions.
Mm-hmm.
That's really important to understanding all of this, isn't it? And once again, even think about some of the debates that we've seen take place on the national political stage about whether American exceptionalism can even be questioned
sure.
in recent years. I mean, it's been fascinating for me to watch those political debates.
Certainly not if you're running for high office.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And so once again, I think that's part of this cultural sediment too, isn't it?
Yes.
That is extremely deep and in many ways not conscious, but also available then to be used intentionally as a kind of manipulative force. And it certainly is. We can see that happen in commonly.
Yeah. Yeah, there's two themes that you bring up here in the book about war culture and sacrifice that are it's kind of chilling. You know, the first is the idea of how victimization discourse has supplanted reasonable outcomes assessment
mm-hmm.
to make the case for military action after September 11th. And the second, you know, quoting you from the introduction, there is, quote, the assumption that violence is masterful, effective, and determinative. In a word, necessary, end quote. It strikes me this is a form of war without end, you know, but also for not just, you know, war without end, but also total war of unlimited means against the stated enemy. I mean, am I right? Or,
you know, we don't own the corner in the United States on victimage rhetoric.
Right.
This is a very it's sort of a universal rhetorical fallback.
Yeah.
And again, victimage rhetoric is something that we can trace and that scholars have traced back to the very beginnings of American history, so that those of us on our side, whatever our side is, we portray ourselves as innocent, aggrieved, peace-loving, superior, over against whoever the barbarian is that represents the flavor of the day. And they always are guilty, evil, irrational, base, violence-prone. What I have come to understand is that the very structures of our militarized violence tend to sanitize victimage rhetoric. So that it's curious to me that I have observed that the reaction in our culture to, let's say, the horrific beheading of a victim by ISIS raises such a strong reaction. But in contrast, there's very little reaction to what I think we could describe as perhaps equally barbaric when a drone strike takes out an entire innocent family.
Right.
What's going on in terms of the differences between those national reactions? And again, what I see is that the structures of our militarized violence also now play a role in the way that victimage rhetoric works
right.
in the United States. And I think that that's an important thing for scholars to continue to analyze. But can I say one other thing?
Yeah, of course.
I think it's also important for us to keep in mind that while victimage rhetoric can be traced back to the very beginnings of American history, other different traditions coexist and tend to be less well-known, or at least much less cited, and much less studied. And they're certainly much less in the public history school books of children in our school. So, for instance, one favorite for me is the story of my own state, where I live, Pennsylvania, and the life of William Penn. I recently came across a letter in an anthology written by William Penn in the 17th century that stands in such contrast to the victimage rhetoric that painted the indigenous people of this continent as barbarians, and that language that fomented and excused the genocidal violence against them. So in 1861, Penn composed this letter.
1761.
Excuse me, 1761, yeah. That was given to read to the Indians before he arrived to this continent. And he addresses them as my friends. Mm-hmm. And then could I just share one line, because I think it's really just quite remarkable. He says, I have a great love and regard towards you, and I desire to win and gain your love and friendship by a kind, just, and peaceable life. And the people I send are of the same mind, and shall in all things behave themselves accordingly. And then he signs the letter, I am your loving friend, William Penn. Mm. What a contrast. And so I find myself really thinking quite a lot about these different traditions in our history and in our culture that coexist.
Yeah.
And what it is that sometimes tends to give much more credence or sway to one as opposed to the other?
Yeah. I again, you know, the military historian here pops on. You know, I think of John Dower's work, War Without Mercy, which he describes, of course, the horrors of the encounters between the American soldiers and the Japanese soldiers and sailors and Marines in the Pacific War.
Mm.
And yet at the end of the war, and it's become, you know, it kind of feeds into a common trope about American military action. At the end of the war, after the violence is put aside, the United States willfully sets out to rehabilitate and reshape and befriend the Japanese.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, that's a specific example, but we look at the history of American conflict, the real history of American conflict, and we see this being played out again and again. And I think, for me, I mean, as a person talking here, it really identifies, as you're saying, this alternative thread of American identity and of American self-imagery and self-imagination that pervades our history alongside of the sacrificial victimization rhetoric. We do lose sight of that.
And it is really quite remarkable, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, one wonders what, I mean, well, I think of the work of communication scholar Robert Ivies, his work has been really helpful for me. He talks about the, what he calls the rights of humanization that he wishes we would increase in the United States so that this alternative tradition would be more highly visible and taught and experienced and actually cherished as a really important part of our self-identity as Americans.
Right.
And instead, I think what happens is that, particularly in times of potential or actual war,
mm-hmm.
it's this other part of our identity that comes to the fore and takes center stage.
Right. Well, I mean, it's certainly, I think, you know, it falls in with the schema you present of the cyclical nature of militarism in American society. Yeah, I mean, because, you know, you point out there's at least three distinct indicators that we can measure the appeal of militarism in our history since the Second World War. You know, you cite Korea, Vietnam, the Reagan administration, and then the current, you know, or the more recent example of the second Bush administration of an expanded military expenditure.
That actually comes from my study of Chalmers Johnson's work. And his point in identifying those three episodes is that these represented continued spikes in military expansion and expenditure. And he's not alone in this, identifying the post-World War II period as unique in American history because we did not really significantly de-escalate from militarism. And more recently, I've been really struck by the work of Paul Koistinen, who's his work.
I know Paul Koistinen's work, yes.
Okay, so do you know his most recent volume about the political economy of warfare from 1945 to 2011, where he analyzes what happened in the economy of the United States? And he sees this this period from 1945 onwards as being really a departure from what happened in our history up to that point.
That's essential. And I think that many of the war and society scholars, many, many military history scholars too, and particularly my mentor, whom I studied under, Russell Wigley, would certainly agree that the Second World War does mark this sharp revision of traditional American outlooks, not just towards military spending, but the role of the standing military in a peacetime society.
Right, and that plays back into what I'm calling interpenetration.
Yeah.
Is that this is what makes this period different, is that we see this sort of leap, and Frieda Berrigan has called it the leap and creep of militarization into all kinds of sectors that were formerly considered civilian.
Right, right.
So, I mean, ultimately, Koistinen says that we really have become a national security state.
Mm-hmm.
And simultaneously, what I have learned, at least from the many audiences that I've spoken to, is that the vast majority of Americans do not think of themselves in this way.
No, they may work directly or tangentially for the military, in the military industrial complex.
Yes.
And not realize it. Absolutely.
So, but isn't that an interesting nut to try to crack?
Oh, absolutely.
How does that remain the case? That this sort of blindness, or is it blindness? And this is just an ongoing question for me. To what degree is it blindness? To what degree is it willful avoidance, such as Boyer describes about post-Hiroshima America?
Mm-hmm.
To what degree is it psychic numbing? I mean, to draw from Robert Lifton. I mean, what is this?
Or it's a case where we in a postmodern society are so distracted and so consumed with the chaff that's around us that we can't really penetrate it to identify what the root trends are directing our behavior.
Well, society. I think, yes, and here again, I think that the fact that so much of this is now highly systematized and embedded in huge structural realities does make it much more difficult for Americans to understand and analyze what is going on.
Sure. I mean, you know, what was happening with the NSA that was revealed last year, it wasn't just something that happened during the Obama years. It's been going on for decades. And yet we're blind to it until it's actually waved in our face.
That's right.
Well, what then does this portend for the place of traditional theocratic notions and theories of war? You know, I'm thinking about the place of just war theory and theories of moral proportionality in warfare. You know, again, I turn back to the descriptions that you're sharing with us of sacrifice and victimization rhetoric. It seems to imply an all-or-nothing approach to war with little use for restraint.
It does strike me that, in many ways, just war is sort of built upon sacrificial logic. The principles of just war all operate with a kind of calculus, right? That the violence and destructiveness of war is permissible in exchange for other things that are supposedly of a higher benefit.
Right.
That's the way all of the principles of just war work. That, at its foundation, is sacrificial logic. So once again, I'm wondering, this generates suspicion for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm actually suspicious of just war on two levels. I'm really suspicious of the way that just war rhetoric has been used to sort of sanitize or mask the realities of war.
That's an interesting perspective. Okay.
Recently, I've been acquainted with the work of Robert Maher from Hampshire University. He's a classicist. He's written a book called Killing from the Inside Out that traces the ascendancy or the triumphalism of Christian just war theory throughout the centuries of Western Christendom.
Mm-hmm.
And the way in which just war theory made promises that it really couldn't keep.
Right.
That it promised that there could be a sort of sanctioned shedding of blood that could be quote unquote sinless.
Right.
And ultimately what we are learning, I think, not only what we're learning today, but we see echoes of this going all the way back really to the ancient Greeks. We're learning that that's really not true. And I don't know if you're familiar with the terminology of moral injury.
Yes, I am.
Okay, so this is an area that I'm beginning to do work in now. People who are working on moral injury are beginning to understand, I think in a deeper way, the very deep wounds that result from people engaging in quote-unquote sanctioned shedding of blood, but that nevertheless goes deeply against a person's moral code.
Mm-hmm.
And that is sort of, that results in a loss of humanity, even a loss of what Robert Maher calls one's soul. Just war theory engenders suspicion for me, both in terms of its logic and its promises, but then also, especially in the post 9/11 period, it engenders suspicion for me because I have observed it being really manipulated as a tool, as another form of rhetoric, to portray certain parts of what war is all about and to hide other realities of war.
That's interesting because, I mean, as I have watched and observe the place of just war rhetoric since 2001, it's been offered as almost a means to press for restraint on the conflict. That's how I've seen it when it's been raised, particularly talking about the legality of the most recent conflict in Iraq. And I guess that's a complete opposite spectrum from how you're portraying it as a tool to facilitate the conflict.
Well, I've seen the rhetoric. I'm not thinking about, I suppose that this does function differently at the upper levels of public policy and international engagement, right?
Perhaps.
But in terms of again, what political speech is.
Right.
In terms of military culture, this language is all over the map.
It is. And again, it raises issues, or not issues, but questions for me, because as a person who's interested in war and society, and the place of war and military institutions within our society, it's a very interesting and almost counterintuitive way of looking at just war theory, as I have been trained to look at it. That's what I find very fascinating.
What do you mean? Looking at
how the doctrine of just war has been used to argue for moral proportionality in violence and for restraint in the exercise of violence against civilian populations. But then as you describe it, of course, as a historian, I look back at the case studies. It's very rare where just war theory, despite being espoused and vocalized, is actually followed or observed, particularly in 20th century war.
I guess here's the way that here's what comes to mind for me. And I learn a lot from actually talking about these things with my students in my classes.
Oh, sure. I learn a lot from my students.
I'm sure you do
class.
Too.
Yeah.
The thinking of, and this I'm putting invisible quotation marks around this, the necessity of war as sacrifice. This kind of thinking is on the lips of my students and has been for years.
Oh, sure. I've seen the same thing where I am at, yeah.
But now let's think about, that is essentially just war kind of thinking. It's necessary. It's a sacrifice that we have to make. This kind of language, by the way, is also all over Obama's Nobel Prize speech.
It is.
So this is the kind of language and logic that is, you raise the issue of proportionality. While that language is prevalent, if I raise deeper questions about what those principles actually question, let's say proportionality. I might ask my students how many U.S. service members have died. They might have a general idea. How many people in Iraq or Afghanistan have died? Absolutely. Not only do they not have any idea of a relative number, but they're not even really aware that they don't know until I ask the question.
Yeah.
So what does that say about just war thinking and logic as a form of restraint? It seems to me that culturally, just war has operated in precisely the opposite way, at least in the post 9/11 period, within our culture. I don't know. I'm not a scholar of, and I'm not privy to the intricate machinations of these dialogues at very high levels of public policy and international relations.
But
at the level of popular culture, it seems to me that it has been a kind of easement into war, a way of rationalizing war, much more so than a way of really holding ourselves to any kind of restraint or account. I don't think that it's performed in that way at all.
Right. I suspect the same is true in the higher levels of discourse as well. I don't see it as a tool necessarily to successfully make a case for restraint during the Bush administration.
And going back to Maher's study of just war across the centuries, it seems to me that he demonstrates that pretty much this is the way that it always has operated, that it rarely has operated very much to restrain as much as to rationalize
its powers to assuage rather than to restrain.
Exactly.
That's interesting.
And I would say one other thing about Just War II, and that is that I have come to question whether, at least in this current chapter of our historical experience, it really isn't this deeper cultural sediment that we've been talking about regarding American identity, where sacrifice and the necessity of bloodshed fit in, that aren't stronger kind of motivating factors for our decision making than just war calculations. I really wonder about that.
Yeah.
I worry about the degree to which the decisions that we make and the kind of the cultural atmosphere that we engender is much more influenced by that deeper cultural sediment.
You know, I can't help but think about the relationship between what you've written and earlier correctives that have been written over American history, you know, ranging from Jefferson, Thomas Jefferson and Mark Twain about militarism and war, to William Ackman Williams or Richard Hofstadter, who's written about the dangers not only of militarism, but of the cultural baggage that goes along with it. And I have to ask, you know, is this particular moment, you feel, different from these earlier times? And if so, how do we reverse this trend while at the same time not losing focus on the very real importance of understanding the place of war and military institutions in our society and the Republic? You know, I would make the case that it's very essential that we teach about war, not to prepare for it, but rather to inform the citizenry of what is really at stake in war.
I think that's really well said. Well, one of the things that I have found myself doing over these years is collecting examples of sacrificial war culture, and your reference to Thomas Jefferson made me think of one famous quote from him.
Yeah.
Do you know this quote? I'm going to try to remember it. The tree of liberty must be refreshed from time to time with the blood of tyrants and patriots.
Yes. Yeah.
But I mean, to get to the point of, you know, sort of what should we do? This is something that I have given quite a lot of thought to, and what I've really identified are three different approaches. I think the first thing that is incumbent upon us is simply to be honest about our reality, to recognize our reality, and for me that means conscientization with respect to sacrificial war culture, and so what I try to do is raise from the level of invisibility to visibility and consciousness these examples of sacrificial war culture. I think I want to encourage people to look at them, to think about them, to deconstruct them, to understand how they are operating and what their consequences are. That is hugely important and work that really needs to be done. And I do this with groups. Sometimes I will take examples of sacrificial war culture and simply present them, and then we'll do a group exercise where we deconstruct it together and then imagine alternatives or imagine ways of responding to kind of disempower the effect of these examples. The second step is what I've called de-transcendentalization. And that's a word that I've borrowed from a Brazilian liberation theologian, Mo Jung Sung.
Mm-hmm.
He has written about the transcendentalization of sacrifice, actually in economics in Latin America. Really fascinating, a corollary to what we find in the United States with war culture, that specifically religious sacrificial language in Latin America was used to justify otherwise really horrific austerity economic programs that place the burden on the poorest of the poor.
Right.
And so he talks about the importance of de-transcendentalizing the economy, the way that we talk about the market, and returning this to the level of a human construction. And I think that maybe something similar needs to happen with the way we think about war. We sing in our national anthems about. Now we have all kinds of websites in our popular culture emblemizes war as something that is at least quasi-religious, and at least in part through sacrificial mechanisms. Although I would say that all of this language of American exceptionalism that we've talked about also plays a really powerful role.
Oh, yes.
And so I wonder, how can we de-transcendentalize all of this and return our approach, return our understanding to seeing war as a human construction? And if it's a human construction, that means that we don't have to always do things the way that we've done them, and we can see it differently.
Right.
And imagine alternatives. I don't know exactly what those would be, but I think the first step is to strip away this layer. Well, what I call the omniscient sacred canopy that surrounds the ways that we think about and practice war. And then the last element of address that I'm working on has to do specifically with people who identify themselves as Christians.
Mm-hmm.
I think that because Christian sacrificial imagery and thinking has played such an important part in increasing and sanctifying war culture.
Mm-hmm.
It's incumbent upon those who self-identify as Christians to think more deeply about sacrifice and the role that it plays for themselves religiously, as well as politically and culturally.
Certainly the casual expression of it.
Well, for me, this would happen on two levels. One, it would happen on the level of the way that sacrificial Christian imagery is sort of colonized by the military and the state for the purposes of either sanitizing or sacralizing war.
Right.
But I think that I also believe that there is a deeper criticism, and this is a kind of internal theological Christian issue. I don't know if your listeners will find this interesting, but I believe that sacrificial theology is inherently problematic. And I want to do some serious theological writing about this. I have done some writing about it, but I want to take that much further if I live long enough.
Well, that's a good feed into our next question. We're coming to the close of the interview. And, you know, we have a couple final questions we like to ask our guests.
Okay.
And I guess the first would be, you're leading the way to it. What is your next project?
Well, this spring, I was a lead organizer of a conference that brought together four institutions of higher learning from the Lehigh Valley in Pennsylvania.
Uh-huh.
That conference was called From War to Peace, Drawing on the Power of Narrative and Dialogue to Build a More Just Society. And out of the conference, there are some really pretty amazing proceedings coming from our keynote speakers that I want to edit into a collection that will also include some of my own work on using a theoretical cultural analysis of violence and the way that moral injury is linked to the realities of cultural violence in the United States.
Okay.
So that's what I'm working on right now. The provisional title is Cultural Violence and Moral Injury, War Through a Different Lens.
Okay, okay. What about independent research? Are you going to be returning to these issues in an independent research project in the future? Or?
Well, this issue will build upon the work that I've done on sacrificial war culture.
Mm-hmm.
Because certainly one of the elements in this cultural sediment has very much to do with everything that we've been talking about
right.
this morning.
Right.
And so I want to explore that more deeply. How is sacrificial war culture a kind of soil that prepares the way for the bitter flora of moral injury to take place.
That's evocative. Interesting.
So that's one of the questions that I'm going to be working on, that I am working on.
Gotcha.
With respect to that. And I have continued since the publication of my book to work on sacrificial war culture in a number of different ways. I've analyzed Obama's Nobel Prize speech and juxtaposed it with Martin Luther King's Beyond Vietnam speech. I've also worked on more on the facet of the political economy and its relationship to sacrificial war culture. Mm-hmm. I have articles published. You saw the piece in the Library of Social Science.
Yes, I did. That's
where I responded to Elizabeth Stamets' wonderful article in Foreign Policy, where she asked about whether Americans can ever agree or ever declare that a war has been in vain or a death has been in vain.
Right.
That's a really important question. So this is all part of my current labor.
Certainly have a lot cut out for yourself. Well, the second question I ask, that we like to ask our guests, is what you're reading lately and what you might recommend to curious listeners if you like to expand their horizons. So what's on your short summer reading list?
Mm-hmm. Well, I've been returning to, I think this is a fairly recent book, a collection by Douglas Frye, War, Peace, and Human Nature. I don't know if you're familiar with the subtitle is The Convergence of Evolutionary and Cultural Views, and the contributors to this volume really are asking about the way in which archaeology and ethnography can shed light on how and why war developed in human existence, and what may or may not be said about our understandings of the human person with respect to war and violence. And I'm really fascinated especially by some of the contributors talking about certain elements in human societies that they call the preconditions for war that develop over time, and the way in which other sets of preconditions either mitigate against or provide restraints upon or have a kind of de-escalating force on war and violence. So that's a really interesting. So a lot of my reading is in this area. I'm also reading Karen Armstrong's new book, Fields of Blood.
Yes, yes.
And, you know, the other thing that I read pretty widely in lots of different areas. Of course, I'm also reading always in theology. Terence Rhine's book, Jesus Christ, Peacemaker, Toward a New Theology of Peace, is a really useful book that I've recently read. And lastly, I guess I would say I find it really useful to read literature. Mm-hmm. And I'm utterly fascinated by a new body of literature that recent veterans of our wars are writing.
Right.
And there are a number that I would recommend. Maybe the one at the top of my list would be Ben Fountain's Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk.
Okay.
It's just a marvelous novel that really skewers sacrificial American war culture.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's fascinating to me to find that it is maybe those who are writing literature who have the deepest understanding of these dynamics and the way that they operate on the American scene.
Mm.
That's a fantastic book that explores this, and that's another thing, actually, that I hope to write about.
Well, great. Well, Kelly, I appreciate you taking the time to speak with me today and giving our listeners an opportunity to get to know your work.
Bob, thank you so much for this opportunity. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. And to our listeners, this is Bob Wintermute. I'm signing off for New Books in Military History. Thank you again for listening.